Why are police photographing our license plate?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Hello and welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, where we work together to connect the dots between politics and finance, a need for better education, humanity and world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and their desire for equality of opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world, and most of all, embracing creativity and political unity as solutions. Please welcome my guest today, the civic-minded filmmaker and primary instigator of Amoeba Films, Brian Weimer, also the creator of Pepperland. Brian, how are you?
I'm very good. Pepperland, I like that.
Well, let's start with that. What you are trying to create a Pepperland, yes?
When I was a kid, I used to watch The Yellow Submarine at Christmas time. It was my dad's favorite movie. And with this weird Peter Mac, like psychedelic journey with the Beatles and all these great songs and Jeremy Boo and whatever. But at the beginning of it was this place called Pepperland that was idyllic and utopian and had parks and, you know, bears juggling and bands playing and giant words that said love and things like that, and then the blue meanies come and destroy it. But there was this place of possibility and joy, and it would embody at the end when the Beatles sing All You Need Is Love and
yes,
giant words come out. But it left this sort of impression on me of this utopian place. And I think that we see it, you know, you see it in Wizard of Oz,
yes,
in Oz. You know, we have these archetypes, but where are they in our real lives?
So I get the impression you're trying to create one at the Ix Art,
yes,
Park, yes?
Yeah, so we have this opportunity with this space at the Ix property. And the Ix property was formerly a textile factory. And since then, some weird things have happened there. They had Shentai and Wunderkammer, these weird kind of performance carnivals. And there was just sort of a raw space to do something. And I've met the owners of the Ix property, or some of the owners, out at Burning Man, which is a arts festival out in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And that place is Pepperland. I mean, literally. I mean, giant words that say dream or whatever. And,
mm-hmm,
and huge submarines coming out of the desert, or a giant shoe. It looks like a Salvador Dali landscape.
Wow.
But it's not just to look at. It's to inhabit and to crawl over and play music on. And you end up for a week with 70,000 people in the midst of the biggest interactive art exhibit you've ever seen. And the experience of that teaches you, I mean, I make movies.
Mm-hmm.
And when I make movies, you write a script, you find a location, you find actors. You have to create all that.
Yes.
It's in your head, but at the end of the day, it's still fake. With this other notion, it's real. You inhabit it, and you begin to behave differently.
Sure.
You interact with people differently. You don't need a formal invitation. You just start playing music on something, and all of a sudden, somebody you've never met before starts playing music on the other side of it. And then after you know it, there are 20 people around banging on something, making something beautiful that you don't know who these people are. You might see them a day later and sort of have a nod and a wink and say, hey, remember that cool piece of music we played together?
Wow.
But that's the sort of subtle place where we can meet. And I think that the Ix property is at a place that's right near downtown. It sort of neighbors Belmont, which is going through its own growing sort of phases.
Yes.
It's neighboring some of the French of Court. and 6th Street Apartments in Crescent Hall. So there's a lot of low-income housing around there, but also next to ACAT and Open Space, and it's a stone's throw from the downtown mall. And it has this opportunity to be a place where people in Charlottesville of all different backgrounds can come and be together. And a lot of our motto has been to dream.
Yes.
To think about, you know, how we want to live and live it there and take that home with us, this possibility. And that possibility is, if you always wanted to play music and never had the opportunity or the teacher, we're going to try to have teachers there to teach music. We're going to have people teaching all the sorts of things, woodworking, metalworking, glass, concrete, all the sort of art skills, but are also craft skills that you can apply in your lives. They're life skills. And to me, culture, art and culture are what remedies everything. They're the only process that can take something. They can take a tragedy. They can take any sort of life experience and translate it, think about it, and come out with something that is a commentary, a reflection, and perhaps a solution.
Or at least an inspiration for a solution. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the Ix Art Park, you went to Kickstarter and it's fully funded for the first phase to build. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, well, it was funny. Somebody said, oh, you got all your money, so you're totally funded. We raised $20,000 on Kickstarter. The Ix managers, Ludwig Kuttner in particular, chipped in another $20,000, and then $40,000. Now, $40,000 in the art world doesn't really go very far, especially when you're trying to fill 17 acres.
Yes.
But so that's been my job of trying to be as frugal as possible to get artists to be involved, but not to try to take advantage of them, because artists are always put upon to do something for free.
Yes.
So how do we pay the artists? So an honorarium, so they feel that they, you know, that their time has been well spent, and to pay for materials, but to really create big and important things there. So we've done a lot of mural painting. The mural painting's cheap. I mean, it's paint.
Yes.
There is going to be some structural elements. There's one huge thing that's amazing. This guy, Devin Floyd, who works at Monticello, he's planting a meadow in the middle of what was an industrial park.
Wow. That's the Pollock's Path?
Yeah, it's called Pollock's Path. And it will be planting things that are not just regional when people talk about native plants, things that would have been just specifically in Charlottesville, in that particular place 500 years ago.
Wow.
Creating a whole meadow with shrubs and trees and a pathway that follows. There's an underground stream that goes through the property, and there are a lot of underground streams in downtown Charlottesville. That has been paved over, but it will be a path that curves like the sine curve of what a stream would have done. So you have this notion of what this land would have been like, and there are going to be listening stations along the path that pipe down to where the stream is, and you can hear the stream at a bench there.
Oh,
you'll be
goodness.
Surrounded by these plants. There will have butterflies and ultraviolet. It's going to be a totally unique experience that actually this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, school kids from Renaissance School, Candom School are going to be coming and planting it. So it's a great educational opportunity for kids, for adults, everyone.
I was going to say earlier, everything you're describing seems very family-oriented and family-friendly, so it's of all ages can enjoy this.
Right. Yeah, so there will be things for younger people, but I think that adults, too, need to indulge their imagination.
Yeah.
I don't think we become adults and just turn off. I think that we have opportunity to, you know, we still have novels in us. We still have songs in us. We still have, actually, we have an opening in 2 weeks, and a whole group of dancers wants to do a bunch of performances.
Mm.
But is dance just for professionals? No, it's for people who like to do swing dancing or people who like to do line dancing. There might be flamenco dancers.
Wow.
But all the kind of things that we celebrate in our lives, and there'll be a place to do that.
Well, see, that's what appeals to me, because except for we artists who sort of hold on to that imagination and creativity, I mean, it's what we do for love and for life and for career, etc. But most adults don't have have that luxury, they sort of give it up. You know, we get older, and it isn't just, you know, responsibility and getting a 9-to-5 job. It's something that we're kind of conditioned to let go of, that we have in, you know, our childhood imagination. And it sounds like the Ix Art Park is, and this Pollux Path and Meadows, gee, it just sounds like it's a place where we can go to rejuvenate, to refresh, to discover our inner child. I mean, I don't want to get too esoteric about it, but we really do need to get in touch with that creative part of us, because it affects everything.
Yeah, and I think that it hopefully has this ripple effect. Actually, since we did the campaign, we've gotten letters from people in other cities that have said, you know, what a great idea. Can we do this here? And other places in Virginia and elsewhere. And to me, wow, it would be great if every place had, you know, this sort of a resource that you can go, that it's not like the downtown mall, where I love the downtown mall, but frankly, you got to pay for something to sit down there.
Yeah.
This place is sort of non-commercial, that you can sit. Actually, we've got a whole bunch of artist benches that we're commissioning, so you can sit, you can lie down, you can take a nap on the ground. Who let you do that? Yeah, so why not? I mean, there is a pragmatism to all this, but also, I don't like being overly pragmatic in that sort of utilitarian, you know, we need to build this because of the revenue or because of a tax base or whatever. To me, possibility. I mean, the arts create possibility.
Yes.
And it's creating something, and recently I've been going through this thing of when is something art and when is something not art, because as a filmmaker, I mean, we have to create everything from scratch.
Sure.
You have to start at a vision that nobody gets, and then you have to gradually build it.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I was working with some students from UVA. They did these, they were architecture students, and they did these little pod structures out of sort of reusable materials, and people did some of the egg cartons and newspapers and cardboard, and there were some that were made out of like solo plastic cups.
Wow.
And it was fascinating to me when something is junk and when it becomes art, and when it's in the hands of somebody who can see what it could become, it can all of a sudden become something beautiful.
Mm.
But how fragile that is too, because the second somebody jumps on it and crushes it, it becomes junk again.
Well, this is fascinating, Brian. What is this geodesic nature dome? This is geometry, what?
Well, these geodesic domes are sort of half domes that are made up of pipes, and it's sort of like Buckminster Fuller, you know, it's a structure that is made up of, I think they're hexagons or octagons, that is very structurally stable, that people use. They use them a lot at Burning Man.
Sure.
And elsewhere, but they brought one back from Burning Man, and they're putting it on the property, and it will be woven with grapevines and have wisteria growing over it, and we're going to do a stone sort of mosaic on the floor, and it'll be a space where people can come in and sit, meditate, or sing, or just lie down, or anything. But it'll be a very interesting space on the property, and again, it's another thing, you're like, okay, I never knew I needed one of those,
yeah.
So once you go into it, you're going to say, wow, can I have one? You know, can I put one in my backyard? That's what I think artists do, is they create things that we don't imagine for ourselves, and all of a sudden when we see it, we wonder how we ever lived without it.
Well, this sounds like a gigantic project, and just spatially, how huge is the Ix Art Park?
The Ix property altogether is 17 acres.
Wow.
We're not at this point. I mean, our $40,000 is not going to sell that whole thing. We're doing about half of that, and even that $40,000 is just the beginning of the fundraising.
Yes.
We're doing a 5K race in 2 weeks, this rainbow rush where you throw paint on people. And,
that's May 25th, yes?
Yeah, and that will help go fund it. We still have to do a lot of cocktail parties. We're looking for grants. I mean, really, when I first approached, I called around to some other art parks in the country, and I said, do you have any advice for me? And one of them wrote back and said, well, just be sure that your board has 5 years of funding before you even start.
Oh,
and
geez.
I had to say, oh, yes, my board.
Yeah.
And 5 years of funding. So we do have a board, though. We have about five people, some of them from the X property, some from the community, who are helping to oversee this and sort of help curate the work.
Gotcha.
But it's a lot of work to do for myself and these people. So a lot of it is trying to raise money for somebody who will manage this, because it's not just a place that will be static. We're going to have events there all the time.
Mm.
And just managing those events is a full-time job. So a lot with me and as a filmmaker, and especially an indie filmmaker, that's what my job is. How do you maximize the production value of your resources?
Yes. Tell me, since we mentioned it, let's give some details, a website or whatever. The Rainbow Rush is a 5K fundraiser race, and it's happening on May 25th. Do people have to sort of register online?
They can register at rainbowrush5k.com. It's a pretty simple registration. It's a $30 ticket, which is pretty par for the course for these kind of fundraisers. And what happens is you wear white, and it is actually influenced by a Indian festival, Asian Indian, that they throw colored powder on people.
Ah.
But they've been doing these across country, and there's several knockoffs, a color run and a vibrant run and all sorts of other knockoffs that people are fairly familiar, and you kind of end up the race and you're just covered in color, and it's billed as the world's most fun 5K. you walk or run 3 miles,
uh-huh.
Family friendly, you go any pace you want. And at the end, we're going to have bands. Christian Breeden's Mysterious Concoction is going to play. Beleza Brazil is going to play. We have a DJ. There are going to be food trucks. So it's going to be a huge picnic afterwards. I just thought it'd be fun to see hundreds of people all covered in color sitting down for a picnic while people are dancing and playing music around them in a sculpture garden. I'm just like, wow.
And I hope we're putting it all on camera.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds grand. Now, let's get serious. What's with this 15,000-square-foot graffiti wall?
I live in Belmont, and right nearby me is a wall near the Belmont Bridge that graffiti artists have been keeping up for years.
Yes.
And they do some amazing, amazing work on it. And I kind of went down and started talking to these guys, and I said, well, I have this giant 15,000-square-foot wall on the side of the warehouse. They do something with it. And it was one of the first things, when we didn't even have any funding, that we threw in a couple grand. It was about $1,000 for the paint alone. And then we gave them about $1,000 as an artist commission. And 12 artists contributed to this giant graffiti wall. And I can't say that graffiti is for everybody, but graffiti is really interesting from afar and from up close. And what is the meaning of it?
Mm.
I mean, where it arose from. You can't just say, well, you know, that's just defacing something. It's like, well, why did that happen? What is a tag? Is a tag about somebody who's disempowered and is taking back that power in some sort of anonymous, you know, this is my presence here, and take note of me, and how artful they are, how abstract they can be. Some of it's figurative, some of it looks like text, some of it looks like a mandala, and how does that all work together? And they came up with a space theme, so it's got spaceships and aliens and all sorts of, like, planets, and a lot of, like, interesting quotes about how space is the breath of art, I don't know, it just sort of, and a lot of people in the neighborhood, actually, I have heard very few, I think that graffiti can be controversial, but I've only heard good things. People of all walks of life have been coming up and saying, wow, this is amazing. Actually, a bunch of rock bands now want to shoot music videos there.
That's great.
That was the other piece of possibility, where you can take a place and by just a coat of paint in a particular pattern, you've changed it from being this was a parking lot and now it's a venue.
Yeah.
We had a little event at the end of Tom Tom where we had some DJs playing and projecting on a wall and some acrobats and some other crazy stuff. And the big backdrop was this graffiti wall. And here, 2 weeks previous, it was literally a parking lot with a wall. And now I had a concert promoter approaching me and saying, hey, I hear you're the guy to talk to book this space. It's interesting that that just your creativity, you create a venue.
Yes.
And that venue creates opportunity for work, jobs, revenues, all sorts of things. And it's like, oh, we're creating jobs.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it wasn't some deliberate, like, we have a plan of job creation with whatever. But to me, that's been my experience with filmmaking.
Yes.
Where you have an idea, and you say, well, okay, we're going to need somebody to paint the set, and somebody to act, and somebody
yes.
to do cameras, and somebody to do promotion. And all of a sudden, you've created, you know, 24 jobs just in the notion of I'm making a movie.
Yes.
And an art park is a physical reality of that, and we can do it on a daily basis. So I think that the opportunity is not just some hippy-dippy, artsy-fartsy notion of, you know, that this is, it isn't the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
The art is the cake.
Gotcha. And the cake changes everyone who has a taste. That's it.
Exactly.
Whether you're baking the cake or eating the cake, it has a profound effect on you. Listen, we're going to take a short break, everyone. I'm talking to Brian Weimer, filmmaker par excellence and civic-minded. He's creating X Art Park, and it's an amazing story. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, among other things, the grand opening Memorial Day weekend, May 25th, the same day as the Rainbow Rush race. But we'll be right back with Brian Weimer. Don't go away. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is filmmaker, and I should say he does TV and video as well, and has directed me, for, among others, Brian Weimer, who is creating his own Pepperland at the X Art Park, which is already changing lives, it seems. The art is there, but also the space itself is there, or is growing and being developed to be there, where you can just sit and appreciate not only art, but nature, history, your own creation. Just listening to you, Brian, I go, wow, how is that all in one place? And it's because I think of the people you're bringing together now and creating jobs. How bad is that, huh?
Not bad. And just think that we only thought of this thing about in November, and it's going to have its opening in 2 weeks.
Wow.
Which to me, I mean, again, going back to this Burning Man thing, Burning Man only exists for a week. 70,000 people converge on the desert and make a city that has traffic patterns, has sanitation, has its own sort of police force, has its own medical care, and then it disappears. And to me, I've been involved civically in different projects, and it's always frustrating how slowly things can move civically.
Uh-huh.
And to me, I'm not going to wait for somebody to give me approval. I mean, I have to get approval from the X people, but working privately, we get to say, this is what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can't make noise and disturb the neighbors, and there are certain regulations we have to follow. But to me, it's like, I'm not going to wait until I have $1 million to, you know, do this upright.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the great is often the enemy of the good.
Yes.
I'm not going to wait until it's perfect. I mean, I think that my filmmaking a little bit reflects that. I can't say I've ever made a perfect movie, but I've made a lot. I mean, I've made, six feature films
yes.
in the past 5 years, and one of them was Claw, the documentary
yes.
about women's arm wrestling. And it's also a good model of you start it where you can. These
yeah.
ladies started arm wrestling in a bar at the Blue Moon Diner, and then all of a sudden it's nationwide. But nobody's waiting for somebody's approval or sanction to go do it. You just go do it.
Yes. Well, speaking of going and doing it, this grand opening Memorial Day weekend, your mm-hmm. grand opening at the X Art Park, May 25th, we want to be clear about that. Tell us something about what's going to be going on at this grand opening.
So from 1 to 6 p.m., the Rainbow Rush, the 5K race, is going to start it off. But that
mm-hmm.
only lasts a half hour to an hour. And
mm-hmm.
a bunch of, hopefully, a couple hundred people are going to be coming through the finish line looking like rainbows.
Yeah.
we have a DJ that's going to be playing, and then two great local bands, Christian Breeden's Mysterious Concoction and Beleza, who plays bossa nova and all sorts of other things, as well as we're going to have acrobats. They have a whole rig that they can do aerials off of. They're going to be hanging from silks and rings. They're going to be doing all sorts of crazy stuff. There's a guy who's a street musician who I've met. He's kind of our David Blair or whatever. I mean, he just like does some pretty amazing knock your socks off street magic. There are going to be some other performances. They're going to be a big thing with the park too is participation. So there are going to be several things to participate in. Actually, one of the things that we're doing this weekend in preparation for it is we're painting a big chalkboard, and it's got a title on it and says, "Before I Die, ... And
whoa.
You put in it, and there will be chalk there that you can write up whatever your dream is, whatever it is that you always wanted to do in your life, and sort of a place to voice that and put it on. And that's a big part of the theme of the whole place is dreams. You know, what are your dreams? So to me, I'm still inviting people to come to the art park and to bring your art, to bring your music, to bring your dance, and have this place be a celebration of this, as well as inviting food trucks so you can bring your food. But also, we're painting this weekend 10 picnic tables. We're actually inviting the whole community to come, and they will be public picnic tables always there to come and sit and bring your family or whoever and have your lunch.
Wow.
Because that's sort of this communal notion. Actually, we have this great piece that's a hexagon, and it has porch swings on it. But instead of just a porch swing looking out at something, you look at each other on porch swings.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of the pieces, somebody else is designing something that is pitched pipes that you can hit with a mallet or something, and we're allegedly going to have 3 octaves worth.
Wow.
And actually, probably a small symphony could come and play, but individuals can come and play too, so you can just sit and play on this, and somebody else can start playing another piece, and you can create music even if you aren't trained, you know? And so every piece down there hopefully will have an interactive aspect that on this opening day, on May 25th, you know, anywhere from that 1 to 6. We capped it at 6 because we definitely want to have a good relationship with the neighborhood.
Yes.
And we don't want to disturb people into the night. But the big thing, too, is just inviting people from the neighborhoods, all neighborhoods.
Sure.
To come and share in this.
Excellent. And you end just in time to feed the downtown restaurants. They should be glad to have you there. That's an incredible thing.
Right. And actually, the day before, I believe, on the 24th, Fleaville is happening there, and that's the flea market that happens at Ix. And I think that's becoming a monthly event. But more and more, we want to have these monthly, weekly, daily things happening there. Somebody had proposed a kids' cafe where parents can bring their small children, and the kids can play, and the parents can have coffee, and the kids can play in the park. So it's just something, a resource like that, that, I don't know, it doesn't really exist anywhere. I talked to McGuffey, some of the people who run that, and the notion there was also to create an axis of art along Second Street that connects McGuffey with the Ix Park.
Oh, wow.
That would just run straight through downtown. And I thought that was fascinating. I don't know how to realize that. It's a lot of work to pull that off. But to have this cultural backbone that's going to crisscross the other axis of commerce that is the downtown mall.
Yes. What about these communal artist studios?
Now, that was a big thing. Charlottesville, over the years, has become an expensive place to live.
Yes.
And it has been so at the expense of, among others, artists.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to go other places to either find space to work or find space to live.
Yes.
And we're trying to remedy that as much as possible. And I discovered that there was a space, and the Ix people showed me, and they said, "Oh, well, we've got this big warehouse here. What do we do with that?" And it's 15,000 square feet.
Yes.
And I said, "Well, let's not touch it. Let's, like, what is the lowest price that we can offer it?" And we got down to $5 a square foot, which, if anybody rents office space in Charlottesville, knows that, like, that's crazy.
Yes.
You know, you can actually rented that, but to me it was to find a space so an individual artist could have about 250 square feet or so for $150 a month.
Wow.
And you know, it won't be, you know, developed, you know, you'll have shelter, it'll be temperate and all that, but you know, it ain't gonna be, I mean, McGuffey's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that the people who have studios there are really lucky.
Yeah.
But this is for people who really need it. We're gonna have, we're talking about woodworkers, metal workers, and one part part that's partition, and then another part that's sort of an open studio plan, sort of like UVA's studio spaces for their architecture school.
Sure.
Where artists can kind of carve out a space for themselves and work there in a communal way. And that's really important, too, because they will cross-pollinate. So it isn't somebody working in isolation, but it could be a weaver working next to a painter, working next to somebody who does jewelry, working next to somebody else who does God knows what, you know?
They
could be building birdhouses or whatever, but they will influence each other's ideas. But they will also have classroom spaces so that they can teach their craft.
Oh, wow.
We already have, actually, there, the IX people have built bathrooms that will accommodate crowds of about 1,000 people.
Wow.
Not all at once, but
yes.
in a lobby / gallery space where people can exhibit their work. We're even talking about places that they can always be selling their work.
Marvelous.
So trying to fit all of this in, and again, within that teaching notion, these artists can teach their craft, they can practice their craft, they can sell their craft, and try to make it actually, hey, imagine that, sustainable to be an artist.
Yes, that would be wonderful. One of the first things I was told in Charlottesville, you know, I came from New York and the soap opera world, and when I got here, I went around to visit theaters and whatever, and one of the first things I heard, well, you know, you won't make a living as an artist here.
I
went, what? But you certainly are making that not true. And I think, as you say, you start with what you've got and you build it. And as the old film says, people will come. And it sounds like that's what's happening. I mean, this is an incredible, to call it a project is not enough. This is an incredible lifestyle influence on an entire community. And as you say, it's having a rippling effect. So it isn't even just Charlottesville or Albemarle County, Lexington, Richmond, and other places, yes?
Yeah, I think I had just noticed somebody in Lexington who had written in and said, like, oh, wow, can we get something like this here? Actually, Richmond has a similar project going on, I think, down by the riverfront area.
Uh-huh.
They're trying to reclaim some land to do a park sort of thing. But I think more and more, I think that it's a fact of our time.
Yes.
Because we're realizing that, I think that Eisenhower era notion of we're going to build a superhighway,
yes,
and all live in our bedroom communities.
Yes.
It didn't come to pass.
No.
That we realized the city is a great place and that we can live in sort of mixed density, but we want some of the cultural attributes that the city provides. So now we're saying, oh, well, let's look at these spaces here and see what we can provide culturally that you can walk to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a huge part of it, is to really keep it central and accessible, and how that changes our quality of life, where we want to live. I mean, more and more companies are realizing that they want to be places where their workers want to live.
Yes.
And not just where they want to commute to. So that's a big part of it here, is let's make Charlottesville even more a place that is central to itself, that we are almost self-sufficient in what we need. Now, I love going to D.C. and Richmond and all sorts of other places for things, but imagine if we had a world-class art center.
Yes.
Right in our downtown, and we already do. We've got live arts, we've got McGuffey, whatever, but how do we build on that? How do we become this sort of like a national beacon of art curator? I don't know what the word is here, but just the spark. And a lot of it is just willpower. It was funny, the other day I was making a poster for the opening, and I was thinking, God, in 2 weeks we're having an opening of something.
Yes.
That was just an idea several months ago.
Yeah.
And within that, it makes it possible for anybody to do it.
Exactly. You know, I got to say, Brian, I'm reminded two things off the top of my head. My good friend over at Preservation Virginia, Justin Serafin, is always, you should be in touch with him if you don't know him already. Justin is always saying he can't preserve all of history as it was, but to take something that is a very old building, or just as old as the IX building, and make it something new and viable so that it now serves a new purpose. You are preserving and at the same time becoming a 21st century resource, and it sounds like you're doing that. And then my second point is that I think the word you were looking for is the destination.
Right.
And there are a lot of people around here who need to know what you're doing, because they, for instance, Bree Warner over at the Charlottesville Albemarle Convention and Visitors Bureau, she's trying to make Charlottesville I mean, everybody knows about Charlottesville's history, but they don't necessarily know about the culture or the art and creativity and the diversity, and I mean the mix that is just an amazing. I mean, I came here from New York, and in many ways, Charlottesville is like a little New York, and you are making it this kind of. You're adding to that that you can, you know, you can walk by and then walk into this whole creation that allows us to go within and express without. I mean, it's just an amazing project. I don't want to hang up yet.
Okay.
We've talked about so much, and you've explained it so well.
One thing I could add to it too.
Sure.
I mean, well, there's another word that is placemaking, that is sort of, you know, creating these spaces that it's sort of like when you're saying New York,
yes.
Highline Park there,
yes,
with placemaking. You take a underutilized space that was in Hell's Kitchen in the meatpacking district. It was an elevated railroad.
Yes, yes.
You made it a place that all of a sudden everybody's coming from all over the world to see.
Yes.
Experience. And the experience is unique and different, and it fulfills on everything that it promises. The other piece, too, is that notion of history and even the notion of placemaking, that there's an ephemeral quality to this as well,
mm-hmm.
that when people are like, well, you know, what's going to happen when those property owners decide to, you know, build condos or whatever the heck that might happen. And actually, I don't think that the IX owners would necessarily go there, although there was a SIA, the Strategic Initiative area, that analyzed some of that area and what could happen there,
yes.
in the next 20 years. And there were some really amazing plans with that. And that may happen. So people are like, well, what happens to the art park? Well, I think that the art park informs what that is to become. If the
yes.
art park is successful, then you have the notion of a cultural magnet that could happen there. And it displaces potentially other things that aren't as exciting.
Yes.
You say, well, you know, it could be a Walmart. It could be a whatever. You say, well, when you say it could be a cultural magnet and it is self-sustaining and it is a destination, then that's what it becomes. But also, if it doesn't, so what? We will have had several years
yes.
of a space that we could, you know, share our dreams in.
Yes.
And I want to invite some, you know, Buddhist monks to go do a sand mandala that is a beautiful
wow.
thing. At the end of the day, you blow it away.
Yes.
Because,
yes.
you know, that's life. And I don't want to, you know, tell people that everything is there is going to be permanent. It's about the process.
Uh-huh.
It's about the making of it and how you share in that creation and how you can also release it once it's done. I just did a mandala painting in downtown Belmont, and because of the traffic there and they did some road work, about a third of it has eroded away, and you can feel sad and go, well, what happened to your painting? I go, well, we had an amazing day painting it.
Wow.
There were about
yes.
2 dozen kids down there with paintbrushes who now feel that they have a ownership
yes.
of their community.
Yes.
And that's priceless. You can't replace that. You can't recreate that. There's no other program for that. So if that's all that this thing is doing, then we have succeeded.
How about, it's as you say, it is the process, and it's the doing and the self-discovery and then the self-expression. It's all of that. What about, we haven't said, I'm just curious, we haven't mentioned the spoken word or acting or theater. Is there any, go ahead.
Yeah. Interestingly, Play On Theater used to be at the IX property, and now they're becoming a traveling theater.
Uh-huh.
But I purchased from them or inherited from them. Somehow I got from them their stage. I have now a curtain and traveler. I have stage lights. I have flats. I have everything to make an instant theater. And
wow.
the notion, too, was to do sort of a black box theater in the space that had multiple opportunities for events. And I think that, again, here's an opportunity for somebody that can come do their show. That it isn't, I mean, I love live arts. I love all the opportunities for doing theater in town. And I've even spoken with them, and the notion of more opportunities for theater, they don't feel that that's, you know, some threatening competition. It just adds to it. It adds
sure.
to people's opportunities to experience theater in Charlottesville. So, yes, we will have opportunities for outdoor theater, potentially for indoor theater. We're talking about potentially doing a micro cinema.
Wow.
I mean, again, a lot of this, there's a lot of it could be and what if. Some of it depends upon funding, on timing, on who contributes to it. But to me, I'm keeping all those doors open.
Great. All right, we're going to have to end on that. But once again, give us the website for the Rainbow Rush 5K fundraiser race, which will take place on the grand opening of the Ix Art Park on Memorial Day weekend, May 25th. That website again, please, Brian?
The race begins at 1 p.m. You can sign up online at rainbowrush5k.com. It's $30. The money goes to help fund the art park. You can show up day of, but I think the price will probably be $35 if you show up day of. It's just more logistics. But from, I'd say, 11 o'clock to 1 is going to be sign-in, and the race starts at 1, and then it ends at the big picnic and bands and everything else that's happening there.
And life will go on after the grand opening. Thank you
yes,
so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Brian, for being on the show. This has been Brian Weimer, and he speaks for himself. You've heard it. And now let's go support the Ix Art Park on Memorial Day weekend and beyond. Again, Brian, thanks so very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Bye now. Best of luck. Welcome back to our Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with our panel to discuss things as we tend to do. We've got Michelle Opperman, Bernard Hankins, and Daniel L. Garner, and I am Marcello Rolando. And I'm just wondering, you know, just to start off things hot and heavy, as I think about the oppression of student loans, and I like to remind people student loans generally, unless they're a scholarship or a grant, don't come from a university, not even from, by the way, the Department of Education. Loans come from banks. The same ones, by the way, who damaged our economy and who we bailed out, and then we fine fractions of the amount of their bottom line, which they pay us back with the money with which we bailed them out. So I'm just wondering, why even, I shouldn't even say even, but okay, I'm saying even. Why even in a Democratic administration with President Obama, although the White House is not supposed to be directing necessarily the Justice Department, they are supposed to be separate. But we know that's happened ever since at least Nixon. But in any case, why then Eric Holder, the Attorney General, and the Attorneys General, the several that the Bush administration had, since 2008, why are we fining institutions that make a lot more money than we're fining them, if that's a sentence, instead of going after the individuals, the CEOs, the CFOs, the members of the board of directors who made the decisions that took away people's retirement, the homes, credit rating? Why are we not investigating, and putting on trial the individuals responsible?
Well, I think the problem goes beyond finance to cultures and ways of thinking that we've developed in our country, because as you're talking about that, what I think about is, what does the police do? It reminds me of the Michael Moore film where he's like, can you go like arrest these guys?
Yes.
It's like nobody really thinks the police are going to walk into a bank, mm-hmm. find a specific human being and say, you are guilty. It's because the responsibility is displaced across an organization. So if you do that, somebody's going to say, how are you going to arrest me? What about the vice president? What about this guy? He unlocks the door every morning. So there's just that whole, you know, displacing of blame across a group of people, which we don't do just in finance. Like, we do it in school. We do it in politics. It's easy to blame everybody because then nobody has to take the blame. So the question is, how do we figure out that problem, which is, I think, a huge problem, because that's more of a human universal problem of the individual versus the, you know, community, and how does that all come together? So I think we can't just look at the banks themselves. We have to also look at the underlying structures of which we've developed and how we operate with one another.
Well, see, I think that goes to the excuse that they're using. This whole too big to fail thing is based on if we investigate the board of directors, the vice president, the president, the chairman, the you know, CEO, CFO, all that. If we investigate them and we indict any of them, we affect the stock market of that company.
Right.
We may cost jobs of the people, of thousands of people working for that company. All of that may be true, but there needs to be at least some sense of balance between, and I know employment, heavens knows, jobs, 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 that's all we hear, but jobs, jobs, jobs is not the only thing we need to have or to be concerned about, to be a country that is, I won't even say exceptional, to be a country that offers an equality of opportunity, a country that says everyone is equal under the law. Isn't that what it says over the Supreme Court, something like that? Equal justice under the law, something. I'm paraphrasing. But that's not happening in the court system, therefore it's not happening in the penal system, and so it does come back to money, even if it doesn't come back to banks.
Well, the regulators were in bed with the banks. The regulators are put there by the government. If you go after the CEOs of the banks, you're going to get tied to the regulators. Then the regulators go to the government. Then you end up going to the Federal Reserve and Greenspan keeping interest rates low. And then you have a problem where they're creating so many financial devices so quickly that laws and regulations can't be written quick enough to make them illegal. And so consequently, you have a situation where the regulators gave these faulty mortgages AAA ratings. So did they really break any laws? I mean, you see how it gets difficult because they're in bed with the people creating the laws to make everything that they're doing legal. Furthermore, there's a problem with if you don't let the banks fail and it all collapse, then it does become, well, we want to keep this arguably systematically problematic institution around, but we want to just pick out the bad apples. I think it's actually a situation where it may be the case that the institutions themselves will corrupt anyone who is put in them. Mm. So even if you have a really good person who becomes the CEO of one of these banks or what have you, they will turn into a very corrupt individual as a result, because the very act of modern day banking may be that of which is fundamentally flawed. I think on that too, when you get into questions of, say, the student loan and the student debt, which is done by the banks, and I think that's going to be one of our next crises, because it's one of the only debts, I think it's the only debt you can't declare bankruptcy on. And I think also, too, you have so many colleges are reliant on getting back those debts, or at least being able to do some double bookkeeping where they can say these debts will be paid for. We know they'll eventually be paid for, therefore we can go on and build a new building, mm-hmm. assuming we're going to get that money. So if it were the case that the government were to step in and sort of wipe the slate clean on all these debts, it would have some extraordinary ramifications for higher education as a whole, mm-hmm. which might be a very good thing, because I would actually argue that in a way colleges have a monopoly on credentials. They're in a way mm-hmm. too big to mm-hmm. fail in mm-hmm. the same way that banks are too mm-hmm. big to fail. And whenever you have too big to fail institutions, you really can't have much innovation, you can't have really much competition, and it creates platforms where you can get the sort of individuals like you had running the banks, who were very corrupt, but then we can't punish them, because if we punish them, we'd have to tear down the entire system, which would affect us, and that's bad for all.
See, I think that's what the Justice Departments of at least the last two administrations are saying, but I don't think that's an excuse the American public should accept anymore. Too big to fail is already our failing ourselves. And it's not going to go away if you set in stone that, okay, certain segments of the population at a certain economic level in a certain professions are off limits to the Justice Department. That's basically what we've done. Once that becomes so normal, because you know how we Americans are, we get used to our comfort zone. Once that becomes so normal, then okay, the Justice Department on all levels gets to turn to this other segment of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And who are they?
Well, to add, I think the issue is if the Justice Department went after the banks, they'd have to admit that they have to go after themselves, because they created the system that allowed it. So I don't know if it's that we're making excuses for them. I think it's more of why aren't they going after them, because they would have to admit that they were just as much to blame as the bankers.
And I agree, and I know this didn't start with Cheney sitting down with all his chummy Wall Street guys in the White House planning, okay, what's our economic plan?
Mm-hmm.
That was outrageous. But it wasn't the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But again, somewhere along the line, the American public at least has to attempt a pause button.
Yeah, well, I think this makes me think of a lot of things, but kind of going back to like initially some of your words initially, Marcello, on this topic about, you know, loans and who's, you know, it's not the institutions who are making, it's banks that are giving out these loans. But I think about maybe even taking like a step back or even like, or to kind of a step back further from the more like overblown instances of like too big to fail or big banks, blah, blah. You know, it's just the fact that like loans happen, you know. So credit can be a very good, you know, it's very good that that can happen. The only problem is when there's very little accountability. But obviously, that's why like big interest can help you. You know, it's almost like you have a greater responsibility, right? Because you have a sense of urgency in paying that that back. But I think the tricky thing is like we've become. When I think about college primarily, well, right, because we're talking about, you know, college debt. It's because college, and Daniel has already alluded to this, but it's almost like if you can't get a good job if you don't go to college. It's not necessarily true. You can probably make your own way, but it will be tough. Now, like perhaps that's a good sort of standard, a good like, you know, sort of hoop to go through, but at the same time that also makes it nearly impossible for a lot of, you know, the country. So I think like the fact that colleges are now, it's just a norm that you go to college, makes people inclined to take out loans to go to college, which maybe they shouldn't take out. I'm not saying that they just shouldn't go to college. I think college is a great thing, right? But college is not the only place that you can be educated, and colleges also should not have this, you know, hold on. It's a type of discrimination. Now, it's not necessarily a bad one, right? But to say, like, you have to have a master's degree at least to apply for this job. It's like, but what if I have this experience or this particular, like, natural skill set as a human being? Does that give me no foot, like, you know, leg to stand on in terms of, like, trying to even apply for this job? You know, it's like, I think there's a lot of, like, things that have to do with credentials and how we validate things today as a society, which puts such an emphasis on having money to pay for those things. But then when we don't, we still feel like we need to. And so loans happen. Like, so there's a lot of loan generation, and loans aren't bad. Again, credit is a great thing, but there's I don't know how to do it exactly, but there could maybe be something we could think about in terms of it being more of an accountable system.
I'd be interested to hear, whenever the first bank was ever started, whoever devised it, what their purpose was. Because it's just interesting to me how in recent years the term bank has taken on this more transcendent sense of the word.
Well, they've gotten on both sides of the equation, but that's really new.
I remember, you know, when I was in school as a little kid, like the idea of a bank was your parents give you a little bit of money, they open up a checking account, you go to the teller, you say, I like to deposit my money, you know, and okay, your money's going to be in the bank, and when you need it, like that's
what it used to be.
Reference that I had of was a bank was this place that kept money for you, and you could take it out when you needed it, but now all of a sudden, it's just steroid. It's like something has been injected with steroids, this Frankenstein monster, which we now have no control over and rules us.
And banks used to also be the middleman. You want money to build a new company or to invest in this, that, or the other thing, or to fix up your house or to buy your house. We're going to go over here and find these people who are looking to invest in someone who wants to do what you want to do, and we're going to bring you guys together, and you work it out, and maybe we'll get a little piece of the pie you deposit with us. And it was a small piece of the pie. Now, however, the banks, the 2008 business, and you know all of the century, especially up until 2008, the banks were allowed to become both sides of that equation. You're looking for an investment, we're going to invest. And we're over here at the same time, you want to build something, we're going to give you a mortgage. It's not worth anything, but that's okay because we now control both sides of the money equation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to say banks even is too general and broad and missing the point. It isn't all banks and it isn't just banks.
Yeah.
But it is, as Bernard is saying, banks have redefined themselves in a way that now the Justice Department is saying basically by inactivity are untouchables. And that's dangerous.
Well, a few things. if you were to make employment testing not so legally risky as it has been after that 1970 Supreme Court ruling, you could have it to where businesses could do employment tests rather than you just have to go to college to get an employment test. That would help break up the monopoly. I think when it comes to the banks, there most certainly are ways to fix this, but they are extraordinarily painful. When you're talking about too big to fail, what that means is if it fails, everything collapses. And the only way to really start resetting the system is to let these sort of student loan bubbles, these bank monopolies break down. But if you are actually in office and you are actually having to make the decision of if you were going to let these things fail or not, I think it would require extraordinary courage to actually let it happen. Because if someone comes up to you and says, Mr. President, if we don't bail out these banks, the entire financial sector and the global economy as we know it will fail. How can you look them in the eyes and say, no, we're going to let them fail? I think that is the almost existential moment that, of course, retrospectively, you can look back and say, oh, they wouldn't have failed. I shouldn't have said, well, that's it. But in the moment where you have to make that decision, I think that's what a lot of this kind of boils down to. And I think it requires extraordinary courage that we should all be very aware of.
I think that's true, and I think the courage is required on more than just a president. It's required on us. And I think also we need to keep in mind that the people we're talking about eliminated 40% of the global economy. 40% of the global economy was wiped away in 2008. So it's not just us. Just as American things like Bank of America and Goldman Sachs are not just American by any means, not even primarily American. So this is, I think, whoever, Obama, his administration, whoever is helping this slow and inconsistent recovery deserves all our support and applause that we can give them, because I think everything is working against them, and there's some people who don't want it to happen, and I think it's not over. And so it may collapse whether we indict them and put them on trial or not. So courage now or courage later when we're less well off.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.